Calling the meeting to order. I'm going to wait just a moment. For Kelly to settle down. Good afternoon, everybody.
Hello.
Hi.
Seems like I haven't seen you guys in a while.
Because you haven't been here.
Oh, there you go. There you go. Okay, so today is Tuesday, October the 27th, 2015. Okay, we have roll call.
Maria DeAnda.
Here.
Jim DeMartini.
Here.
Michael O'Neill.
Here.
Jeff Grover.
Here.
Jason Borda.
Present.
Donna Riley.
Here.
Sam Sharp.
Here.
Joan Clendenin.
Here.
Mike Lynch. Gordon Ford. We have a quorum.
Thank you. Announcements.
I just have one. Michael O'Neill, who currently now sits on the Information Technology Solutions Committee, has graciously volunteered to sit on the steering committee for the Linea project going forward. So he will be a part of that committee. The steering committee just simply meets on an ad hoc basis, and they get information from the consultants about where we are, and they ask for advice going forward.
Okay, I have an announcement. It is with mixed emotions, but I will be leaving the retirement board. I've accepted a job in San Mateo County, effective December the 7th. So I'm going to try to make it back to the meeting, the last meeting on November the 24th. But I'll have just gotten back from an overseas flight. So I may or may not make it.
Is that the week of Thanksgiving?
That is the week of Thanksgiving. We do have a meeting. So anyway, so it'll be sad because I've been here on this board for so long that I actually like this job better than my other job. But anyways, so just wanted to let you guys know.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
What will you be doing?
I will be the Director of Economic Self-Sufficiency in San Mateo County.
Well, isn't that wonderful?
Thank you. Welfare Department.
Awesome.
Isn't December 7th Pearl Harbor Day?
Yes, it is. Don't be mad. We were just talking about that. It's like nobody says the date that will live in infamy. I hope not.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
That is exciting.
Thank you.
Congratulations.
Thank you. And Kelly's mad. Anyways, so with that public comment, no members of the public here. Okay, consent items.
I make a motion to accept the consent calendar.
Second.
Okay, we have a motion and a second. Any more comments? All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? So moved. Six. No, let's see. Oh, did we have the directors in there? Okay. Six, annual update and review of Jackson Square Partners. Welcome.
Thank you. Hi, everybody. Good to see you all again. Kevin Brown. Hopefully you've gotten to know me over the years. Formally introduce Sharon Heyman, who is our head of relationship management. And I'm going to let her give a little bit of background, but her chief role at Jacksonville Partners is to basically to coordinate all of the client service that we do for our institutional clients like yourself. So do you want to just give some background, Sharon?
Sure. Thanks, Kevin. I'm glad to be here today and meet all of you. So as Kevin said, I actually joined Jackson Square Partners earlier this year to focus on the client relationship role. Previous to that, I was at Matthews Asia for a couple years in San Francisco, doing something very similar to that. And before that, I was actually at Delaware Investments for 6.5 years, once again, focusing on client relationships. And that's when I got to know the Jackson Square team, worked with them very closely, worked with a lot of their clients, and had an opportunity to really get to know them, their investment management style. And I happened to be in San Francisco when they did the spin out, so it was a great opportunity for me to join the team and actually work with them and once again work with all of their clients. So it's been a very busy 9 months that I've been there. But it's been great, and I really look forward to working with you and you know, supporting anything that you need from a client level.
It wasn't planned, but it kind of seems like it might have been, but it just wasn't, so you know. But to have worked with someone like Sharon for 6 years when we were all at Delaware together, and then just coincidentally she had moved to San Francisco working for someone else, and then the timing was such that we ended up spinning out from Delaware Investments into our own firm called Jackson Square Partners, which we've talked to you before, and needing someone to coordinate client service. And Sharon had been involved in, you know, 6, 7, 8 accounts that were multi-hundred million, if not a few over a billion. So we just had the interview process. There was no interview process. We'd interviewed her for 6 years, basically. So we were really fortunate that coincidentally she had made the move, and we probably would have made a pretty strong effort to get her anyway to move from Philadelphia. So anyway, Sharon is running all of our client service, is your first point of contact going forward. And just to remind folks that we spun out of Delaware Investments in May of 2014, so about a year and a half ago. Part of that was to continue to have Delaware help us with the day-to-day operations. We had struck a two-year operating transition agreement with them that expires next May. And within that period, we were going to get ourselves prepared by going and hiring people like Sharon, by hiring outsourced vendors, so that we could take on the operating services ourselves. And you should know that the vast majority of those operating services are now being done by us at Jackson Square in San Francisco. In fact, October 1st, almost a month ago, was the day that we really flipped the switch, the big switch, if you will, and flipped from Delaware's trading and trading order management system and their middle and back office infrastructure over into our own. And when I say our own, I'm really talking about us at Jackson Square Partners, along with some outsourced partners like Northern Trust and Charles River and other investment management vendors. So the vast majority of what clients see out of us day to day in terms of the nuts and bolts of trading and reconciliation and reporting and all the month and quarterly and year-end reporting and the human element of relationship management, all now happening out of San Francisco. So pleased to report that it's going as planned. There have been no glitches on that operating transition. So I want to make sure everyone heard that. And obviously happy to answer any questions as it relates to the operating side of what we're doing. Just give you a quick snapshot of where we are in assets. I think we ended the quarter, the September quarter, to 26.3, 26.4 or so billion in assets under management. The large cap growth strategy that you're invested in has always been the lion's share of our assets. It's about 19 billion of the total. And with the help of the market and a couple recent client wins, we're now up over 28 billion in assets under management. So business continues to be good and healthy from that respect. The last thing maybe I'll mention on the business point of view is that we hired the last kind of major functional area we felt like we needed to cover in terms of hiring was a chief compliance officer. We hired a CCO who started at the end of August, so he's been with us for a couple months now. His name's Sean Krieger, 20-year career, has a law degree, 20-year career in compliance and related. He's been a CCO before at other asset management firms, so we're pleased to have him. So all of our compliance now is under a JSP, a Jackson Square Partners professional in our office. So that's kind of the last big functional need we needed, and we think we're pretty good on the employee count for now. We'll pick our heads up sometime middle of next year, make sure we've got the people resources correct, but done with the hiring for now anyway.
Hey Kevin, when the operational transition is complete, what will be the the strategic and the legal relationship with Delaware from that point?
Yeah, good question, because currently we have kind of three relationships with them. One is that this entity called Jackson Square Partners really has two owners. We in San Francisco, the key employees in San Francisco, are one owner, we're the majority partner, and the former parent Delaware and their parent Macquarie Holdings out of Australia. They're the minority partner, so they're an equity partner with us, and we share some economics That's one relationship. The second relationship is this operating agreement that we've had. And even though we're doing the vast majority of those services, technically we still have them as a operating service provider if we need them until May of next year. That's where that two-year period ends. And then the third relationship we have with them is that there's a group of mutual funds and other commingled vehicles that we used to manage when we were employees at Delaware. It's Delaware mutual funds and pooled trusts and variable annuities and things like that. We still manage those funds, but now we manage them not as Delaware employees, we manage them as a third-party sub-advisor. And so it's about $9 billion of our current $28-plus billion in assets is this sub-advisory retail relationship we have with the former parent. And that could end up being somewhat temporary as well, because we agreed to do that for 2 years. We just picked the same two-year period as the operating to make it easy. And so we're in discussions now with Delaware about whether we should extend it. Maybe we should extend some of those funds. Maybe we should go off and start our own funds. I don't know exactly where that's going to end up, but I can just tell you that we'd still like to be in that business. It's different than yours. Your business is very straightforward, and you know, again, 19 or so billion are institutional separate accounts like yourselves. But that $9 billion of assets, it's not that complicated for us. We still look at them as if they're institutional, because that money tends to be big, multi-hundred-million-dollar, in a couple cases, billion-dollar-type placement business. It's not that we're ever going to be in the business of getting across the kitchen table with mom and pop trying to get them to, you know, to sell our mutual funds. It's never going to be that. It's going to be more of an institutional approach to retail. Whether we continue to do that with Delaware as a sub-advisory partner, maybe someone else as a sub-advisory partner, maybe we would offer our own funds, but to be clear, we're not going to be if we did that, it would be on an outsourced basis, almost similar to everything else we thought about with our business, to try to outsource as much of the kind of day-to-day service of that as possible. So there is that retail sub-advisory relationship that we have. Not clear if that's going to end up, you know, continuing past next May, and those are some of the things we're thinking about. Some people have asked if that could be a concern, where you have $9 billion of a retail sub-advisory through them, and that might end, and so does your $28 billion go to $19 billion? And the only thing we can say to that is we don't think there's going to be much disruption. We're hopeful we're going to be able to work out a deal with Delaware. We're not going to have the disruption, or we'll have a clear roadmap for those investors in those funds. But worst case scenario, if there was disruption there, we feel we could replicate that business pretty quickly, either by going and raising more institutional assets. You know, we have five products. You're in one of those. Again, it's the lion's share, the large cap growth strategy. But three of those five strategies are closed and have been closed for like 4 years. And part of that is because there's a fair amount of those retail assets in those strategies. So we could, in theory, we could turn around and open those products again, and we think sell them relatively quickly. So from an economic point of view, we believe we could get those economics back very quickly.
Even if you lost those $9 billion, would that be an imposition on the organization?
Yeah, it's really unlikely we would lose the $9 billion. We believe there's several billion, and there's probably a difference between what I might think that guess is of what part of that $9 billion and what, you know, someone else might think. But we think a lot of that $9 billion is going to want to stay with us. And whether that's in a current Delaware mutual fund or something we offer someday or another sub-advisory relationship we end up having with a different fund, we believe a portion of that $9 billion is going to come find us. So it'll get replicated relatively quick that way. And then if that number is 3, 4, 5, 6 billion, I honestly don't know what that number is. Whatever we have capacity left over, we believe we can go sell institutionally.
Oh, so, much higher margin.
Yeah, that's another thing that we would emphatically tell you, even though I can't give you the details because the terms of our spin out with Delaware are confidential, but it is fair to say that the economics for us would be much better.
Well, yeah, you're a sub-advisor now.
Exactly.
You're a direct advisor.
Yeah. And there, it was also, it's not even really a market sub-advisory deal for us right now, and that was a way to help pay for our independence, basically.
Sure.
So you're right that our economics are going to get better on that book of business in almost any scenario.
Well, I was just going to say, well, and just to that point, Rick, because I think one of the things, we would still have $19 billion in assets under management. So it's not, you know, the economics and everything, that's still a substantial amount of assets under management. So from a financial standpoint and a viability of the firm, you know, that's not an issue.
Yeah. The majority of our economics are in that, currently in that $19 billion book of institutional business, for sure. Vast majority.
Just
anything else from a business or organizational point of view? Happy to get into the investment side of things, and I'm always not sure how much you want me to redo because you've heard me say this every time. 30 to 60 seconds to remind people how we manage money. Just it's a large cap growth strategy.
Do it in 30 seconds.
Yeah. Do I put a shot clock up?
It might be tough.
Yeah, but Sharon, kick me when I get to 60.
Yeah, we typically allow maybe a 20-minute presentation.
Yeah.
And then we'll allow for additional questions.
Fair enough. So just to remind folks maybe who haven't heard as many times as others, our general approach is really kind of three key things. One is that we're pretty concentrated. It's certainly relative to our peer group. It's about 25 to 30 stocks we think is the right number of stocks in a portfolio. It's a long-term time horizon. We think about 3 to 5 year, at least 3 to 5 year time horizon periods that we're trying to think about wanting to own stocks through a full market cycle. And I'm sure everyone probably have a little bit different definition of what a market cycle is. But the point is that we're not trying to do sector rotation. We're not trying to pick inflection points and play them for short periods of time. We really want to own stocks for a long period of time. And then the third thing is that while we're growth investors, and folks like the various folks and others that will do the analytics on our portfolio, we'll end up in the quadrant often that is not just growth, sometimes even aggressive growth. The way that we define growth, you should know, is not driven strictly by revenue growth rates or even reported earnings growth rates. It's the growth of what we call the growth of intrinsic business value, meaning the growth of the actual cash economics of a business. So dollar comes into a business. What do we as a minority equity shareholder, what do we get out of that dollar? What margins do they get out of that dollar revenue? What goes to free cash flow? What does a management team do with that excess free cash flow? Do they put it back into the business? That might be a way for us to get paid as a shareholder in the event that that capital gets a good return and the stock goes up. Do they pay a dividend? Is it a buyback? You know, how do we get paid? And so it's all of those cash-related metrics that we really care about. And so what ends up happening is we can own stocks that are very obviously high revenue growth companies. You'll see in a lot of other growth portfolios, you know, we would argue not many people would own those the same weights that we own them, but, you know, a lot of folks own Google, for example. So we'll have some quote-unquote traditional growthy looking things, but then we'll also, because of the way we think about the growth of intrinsic business value, we'll also have some companies that don't look so obviously growth. They might have moderate, revenue growth, mid-high single-digit revenue growth. Doesn't look that interesting, not that sexy, but we believe there's something going on under the hood. It's a profitability growth story, or maybe a management team is selling assets. Maybe the business mix is changing from low-margin products to high-margin products, something that we think makes an interesting intrinsic business growth story. It's not to try to get ourselves more flexibility than what I've just talked about is the philosophy we've had for literally a couple of decades. This product has 21 years of track record. It's always been 25, 30 stocks. It's always had a long-term horizon, low turnover approach. It's always looked at growth this way. So none of this is new. I just wanted to remind folks what we did. And that was way more than 60 seconds. Sorry. So anyway, that's what we do. We think we have a pretty good sense for the kinds of companies we look for, and I'm happy to just stop anywhere along the line here and talk about specifics, but on 3.1 of your presentation is where we start with some account specifics. It just gives you some assets under management, and then we have some performance statistics on 3.2. We try to provide several periods there to give you some perspective on how we've done, and then we just pick kind of the most recent period if that's interesting, if people think they want to look at what's really helping and hurting. I will tell you that since this, I'm not just picking this month period because it's going our way, but I usually do try to get you some kind of real-time update. The third quarter was, I would say, disappointing to us, not just because we underperformed relative to the index. I mean, that's always disappointing. But I would say that normally in, and empirically this is true, this statistically this is proven out in our strategy, when the market is down on an absolute basis, when you just have negative numbers, we tend to actually hold up better than the market most of the time. And that didn't happen in this third quarter. And it's frustrating when that happens, and it's not very characteristic. And all I can tell you is that we think, and this is admittedly intuitive and qualitative, I've seen some analysis around this that we think reinforces this qualitative opinion, but the sell-off in the third quarter was got, it may have started fundamentally and started with some concerns about you know, the Fed not being able to raise rates, weakness in global economy, China slowing, you know, all these different things that might be going on around the world. But it moved from fundamental somewhere along the line to very technical selling. And whether that meant that the short sellers were having their day, or ETFs are distorting the way flows are moving in the market, or I mean, pick your five or six reasons why selling might have gotten technical. And it really, the stocks that really got hammered in the quarter were very well-owned, liquid stocks. Those are the kinds of stocks that tend to actually hold up in down periods. But in this particular period, they really got hammered, and it really hurt us. And it's not that we didn't have some controversies or some, you know, questions along the way in some of these companies, but we just think the selling got exacerbated. The flip side to all that, thankfully, we were hoping this would be the case, is that we're probably getting more than we deserve now, you know, coming back the other way. And some of that is good fundamentals that are getting reported in earnings that are starting to come out every day now, and some of it is overdone selling that we're now getting the other side of. And so we've had a really powerful move in the first few weeks of October here, and just yesterday and today, we were on a relative basis up 130 basis points or so. So we're now year to date probably we're probably comfortably ahead now on the index after yesterday and today. Today especially was a big day. We were 70 basis points ahead on a day relative. That's a big move for our strategy. So,
what would be a trigger for you to liquidate or bail out on a stock? And I'm thinking. Valerant Pharmaceuticals.
Yeah,
they had an issue.
Valiant.
Yeah. They had an issue, and then eBay is predicted to be kind of flat for a while.
Yeah. So.
Can you repeat the question?
Yeah. The question is, what would cause us to just get out of a position, even though we're long term oriented and you know want to live through some controversy on the margin? We would prefer to own companies for a long time. What would cause us to get out completely? And it. Really, the short answer is that if we think the original stock thesis is broken, then that would cause us to get out. And so we have to kind of go back. And in some cases, that's a thesis that started a year ago, like in the case of Valiant, or it's a thesis on Qualcomm that we owned 15 years ago. You know, and you have to retest your thesis. And is the thesis still playing out, or has it changed, but in a good way? And if we still believe in a 3 to 5 year thesis on a company, our inclination is to stick with it and to live through controversy, which can be very uncomfortable. You know, when you underperform in days, weeks, quarters, years, where you feel like you're not getting paid for what you think is a really good risk reward on a 3 to 5 year time basis. And fortunately, again, this is a couple decades of experience from our investment team of living through this kind of uncomfortable controversy in the past. In Valiant's case, we don't have to go into it unless you'd like to, because jokingly referred to ourselves as Valiant Capital Management in the last couple of weeks. We've spent a lot of time on it. It's been a very, very controversial stock. It's had an amazing move year to date. It was up until, you know, 8 weeks ago, it was our best performing stock. And one of our worst today has gone from 240 to 90 to 130 to 115 to, it's been crazy. And we've had to retest the original thesis. Is it still intact? Has it changed? In their case, it was all of that and then some, including claims out there that there was potential fraud in the company. And I mean, it's been a real soap opera. And so we've just had to double down on the conviction level. For what it's worth, our conclusion is that from what we can tell, it's not fraud. But is there still lasting impacts from what they've gone through, this controversy? Does it still, you know, restrict or limit their ability to do what they would normally do? Do they have to be extra careful now about the way they raise prices, the way they do acquisitions? So we've had to factor that into the thesis. Has it changed the thesis enough from our original thesis, especially today's prices? And our conclusion on that is no. In fact, we've been adding to the position. So I was just telling Sharon on the way here, I think that's going to be, I wouldn't be surprised if that ends up being our best stock in calendar 2016, just because from a pure valuation point of view, it's dislocation is an understatement of what's happened to that stock.
Thank you.
I noticed in Qualcomm, you said you've had it for 15 years.
Yeah.
Actually, even longer than I've been here. But, you know, instead of selling it when it's up,
yeah,
it seems like what you guys do is just wait till it goes down and buy some more.
Yeah.
Which is a strange concept that I don't have myself.
But yeah.
I noticed you're like at almost 6%.
Yep.
And said, wouldn't it be better to just sell it when it was higher rather than buy more of it when it's down?
Yeah, there have been stocks where we have been pretty good at that, at least trimming on strength. We've done that with Google a handful of times where we've owned Google for 8 or 9 years now, and we've done a pretty good job of trimming Google when it's done well and adding to it when it's on its back. You know, it's all degrees, but... And then there have been other ones like Qualcomm where we've almost had it, always had it at the top of the portfolio. And it's just a conviction that we have in the risk-reward there. It's been a little bit – it's another one where we had to retest our original thesis on Qualcomm because they've made their own mistakes and they've had some things happen to them. You know, big royalty fight in China, and they've made their own mistakes in missing a product cycle. And so we've had to determine, are those short-term or relatively short-term? And what's the 3 to 5? Even though that's something we've owned for 15 years, we still think of that as if it was today's new money. What is the 3 to 5 year thesis from today? It's always this rolling 3 to 5 year time horizon decision we make on the portfolio. Now, every day you don't really have to make that decision on 28 stocks you own because either company specific or market wise, you're not being kind of forced to think about it. But when companies go through controversy, you are forced to think about it because stock action is happening in some direction, up or down. And so we've had a retest there. In that particular case, they have new management. It's homegrown management. It's not outside, but it's new management. We think they're going to be finally serious about capital allocation, which is something that's happening in a lot of these tech companies that get to a certain maturity level. Instead of acting as if they're the new hot tech company and hoarding all their cash, and spending a gazillion dollars in R&D and not paying shareholders back, eventually they, I wouldn't say they all because there's a lot of them, but they're starting to get religion, and part of this is because activists are out there making them get the religion on recognizing where they are in the life cycle, being smarter about the way they allocate capital, and starting to pay back shareholders. Qualcomm's starting to do that. We think if they do that even halfway, it's going to be very meaningful for the stock. And so the thesis is the same in one hand in that they've got this great intellectual property position and handsets and wireless infrastructure, but it's also got kind of a new feature, which is this capital allocation program that we think will play out in the next couple of years and we think will be meaningful to the stock.
So you're but adding to it now.
We added in the fourth quarter and the first quarter of this year when the stock was down. It's recovered a bit. It's been weak this last week. There's been a lot of weirdness around a lot of the semiconductor companies have been down, but we did add to it in the fourth quarter and first quarter.
I mean, do you have a maximum level of how much weight you're going to give to this company? You're at 6% and you only have 30 stocks.
Most account guidelines kind of cap us at 8%. It is rare where we have companies, many companies in the sixes. There are times we don't have any companies in the 6% range, and we kind of by our standards, flatten it out to a few at 5%. Apple is probably the most extreme example. Years ago, when it was doing so well, it broke through the 8% level. But it the top weight, the dispersion of weights in our portfolio tend to be around 1% or so at the bottom, and usually on the top end about 6%. Every once in a while, we'll take them above that. But that's what it's an assessment of what we think the risk reward of the stock is, and kind of the higher confidence we have in the risk reward tends to have higher weights and vice versa.
Any
anything else?
Extra sheet here.
Yeah.
As value added through 6/30, what's the value added for the last quarter?
I don't know if Kevin's going to know that.
Yeah, I don't have that sheet, but...
We calculate that internally.
Oh.
And we don't even...
Oh, okay.
We haven't got our custodial bill yet for the last quarter, so I couldn't answer that.
Yeah, it won't look as good. I know that. Yeah, I remember seeing this before.
Oh, and that's actually in dollars.
Yeah, in dollars.
Yeah.
Yeah, it makes it real.
Yeah, you know, actually, Kevin, when you were saying that, you know, the third quarter was a little unusual, actually, I mean, I think we've come to expect that with your portfolio, but in a good way.
Mm.
I mean, when you have gains, your gains on a relative or a magnitude, an absolute basis, seem to outweigh the losses when you incur those. So, obviously, cumulatively, you've been doing... quite well for the organization, at least over the last 5 years.
Well, no, I appreciate that. And the reality is that our we call it upside downside capture, right? Our long term upside downside capture is really attractive in that it gives you a little bit of upside above the market, and then it really protects you well when the market's down. In the last 5 years, though, even though it's been a pretty strong absolute run in the market, despite the volatility recently. You wouldn't think normally that would have been an environment we would do well, and yet we have. And we've talked a little bit about that in this room before, about avoiding kind of the big mistakes and trying to keep kind of a 3 to 5 year horizon and not getting too cyclically exposed when the market gets very excited about, oh, this is finally the time where all of our problems are behind us since the 2008 crisis, and now it's time to get cyclical. And we haven't really gone for that head fake, if you will, and that's really helped us when the market ends up, or the economy, I should say, ends up disappointing.
I would suspect also your turnover must be relatively low because the custodial fees are pretty low.
Although, yeah, don't get too used to that because in the most recent period, including this quarter, we were higher turnover than normal.
Okay.
We had, I think, 5 or 6 stocks that we ended up getting out of in the quarter, but to be fair, I think at least 4, if not 5 of them, we had been trimming in previous quarters, and then finally just kind of made the last move of, you know, in some cases, thinking of like Priceline, for example, where at one point it was a top 5 position, it was a 5 or 6% weight. We had been trimming for the last 3 or 4 quarters, and finally got down into the 2s, and then ended up selling the whole thing. So, the number of positions you may see sold and bought in the quarter is going to look a little overstated because a lot of those were kind of already in transition in one way, shape, or form.
What is the average annual turnover of the portfolio?
From a percentage basis, it tends to be 25-30%, and that includes that's both position changes like full buys and sells and adds and trims. And it's really hard to get the data on how much of it is major position change buys and sells and how much is adds and trims. But our guess is it's 2/3. Maybe 60%, maybe 2/3 full buys and sells, and the balance is adds and trims of your existing portfolio. But at any rate, what it ends up being on average is roughly 5, maybe 7 stocks that we're introducing to the portfolio and 5 or 7 that we're exiting. Again, we're not always doing 1-for-1, but that on average, that's what it ends up being.
But we've definitely been more active this year.
It's just
particularly this last quarter.
We've had a couple of volatile periods this year where we just felt opportunistically. We either because the market is forcing you to really have conviction one way or the other, and you kind of get to an up or out decision on a company, or as I said earlier, maybe we've been trimming and this is just the final thing. Well, geez, we want to add to these companies or buy something new. Let's get rid of it now. It's kind of the decision was made a long time ago that we were going to take the weights down on Adobe and Priceline. These companies have really done well for us. And then this volatility kind of caused us to shake them out of it completely because we wanted to do other things because we had the market down and wanted to be a little more opportunistic about it. So,
thank you.
Yeah. Is this someone's? Can I keep this?
Yeah.
Oh, great. Thanks. I've seen this before. It's interesting.
We do it for everybody that actively manages.
Yeah. No, it's good. It's good. It gets you out of the relative mindset, more in the absolute.
Not just percentages.
Exactly. Yeah, it makes you look at the real dollars. Yeah, it's real money.
And Kevin, it gets posted on the website under the agenda.
So okay.
If you come back again and you want to go see it before, it is.
Okay, good.
Posted.
Thank you. Oh, yeah, we'll do that next time.
It's usually presented with your letter coming as well.
Okay.
That kind of
perfect.
That this time, but it'll get directed to you as well.
Perfect. That's great.
Thanks. Good.
Anything else we can...
Any more questions?
Talk about?
Thank you.
Okay, thank you all.
Thanks.
Thanks as always, for your continued faith in us.
Yeah. Definitely let me know.
We'll root for Valiant.
Yes.
It's quite a soap opera.
You made a prediction.
I have made a prediction. I hope no one wrote that down.
Unless it's well, in which case I'll claim that I made the prediction.
Well, that does take us to the value added.
Monte Carlo and the south of France. Did a bike ride in Vermont.
Going to say something in the grocery.
Yeah.
If you go into
well, you can do that. Are we going to be here? For just
got short timers.
Short timers.
Actually, the hotel game was up to the just walk through it. Didn't play
anything,
walk out. Really, it's strange.
I've never been in it.
Yes.
Thanks a lot.
Good to see you.
Really just like James, a big, magnificent building and a kind of similar few games in the middle, and you can't imagine how they even stay open. There must be a back room or another building somewhere or something, because it's nothing like what you see.
What's that?
I didn't have time to go to it.
I bet 90% of the population.
Value added.
Yeah. No, that's part of this. We're on 7A.
Are we on 7A?
7A.
Oh, sorry. Alrighty. So, Executive Director.
Item 7A, this is a legislative update. This is an information item only, and today we're going to focus on... Okay, I'm sorry. Item 7A is legislative update, and today we're just going to focus on a pension reform initiative that's been floated out there. Some of you might have heard about it already. And information item only, and I'll let Dawn Lee take over from here.
Just recently, there were two separate initiatives filed by Chuck Reed and Carl DeMille. And for pension reform. The first one is very similar to the one that was already put out earlier this year, and they even use the same name, which is currently Voter Empowerment Act of 2016. Most of this initiative is the same as it was earlier this year. This is the one that would not allow us to have a defined benefit plan for new hires unless it was approved by the voters. Also, to enhance an existing defined benefit plan to pay more than a half, pay more than one half of the total cost, or to impose termination fees or accelerated payments for someone trying to get out of a defined benefit plan. All of those things would require voter approval before any of them can happen. The biggest change in this initiative was what they actually took out of the initiative, which was the one section that was going to require voter approval to set employee salaries. So that was removed from this initiative. They also filed a second one, which is a little bit different. This one is, the title of it currently is Government Pension Cap Act of 2016. This one, they went the other direction where they would allow the employers to keep their defined benefit plans, but they put some pretty big restrictions on what could happen with these plans. This time, they're going to put a cap on the amount that the employers can contribute to an employee's retirement plans. And those limits would be 11% of compensation for general members and 13% of compensation for safety members. Now, when you're looking at that 11% or 13%, what's actually included in that is a little bit interesting. They're looking at defined benefit, defined contribution, deferred comp, all of those things that you normally think about, but also they've included Social Security. And because our system in Stanislaus County and most of our employers, they do contribute to Social Security, so that 6.5% or somewhere in that, I'm not positive.
I think it's 7.
Well, that's got the Medicare part. Get it? So it's, I think it's like 6.25
right,
or something in that area is what the employer is paying into Social Security. So right off the top, that would come off of this 11% or 13%.
Wow.
So it does not leave a lot of room for the employer to pay much else into any type of retirement benefit.
So they really don't want employees to have some kind of retirement security.
So they're, you know, two very different types of plans. It's my understanding that they will only plan to take one of these forward to the voters to collect signatures to get it on the ballot for 2016. They're going to wait and see what kind of title and description they get from the Attorney General. Once they've received that, they plan to make their decision, and they've said that they plan to have that information available by Christmas time this year. And then whichever one is chosen, they will go forward to start collecting signatures.
I can just comment on that. Just a couple of things, because this came up at CRCEA last week. I think this is Chuck Reed and his initiative in San Jose. Much of it was overturned in the court. And the second thing was, and this is just opinion of one of the speakers, was, and by the way, I have saved the tunnel bumper stickers for, I mean, it stopped the tunnel bumper stickers for anybody who wants them. They suggested that the state Republican Party is not real hot on either one of these initiatives because of the potential turnout by unions and safety and fire and the teachers and all that stuff. They're afraid that if there's a big turnout against this, that their local races will get impacted, and they really don't want that impact coming down, and they would rather go head-to-head just on the issues rather than having a third party bringing people out of the woodwork to vote. That's just one person's opinion. I thought I'd share that.
Okay. Let's see.
7B, monthly staff report. This is an information item only. I'm going to talk about just one thing really quickly, and then I'm going to hand it over to staff. From the investment governance and compliance standpoint, not a lot went on over the last month. We did go down and meet with Ed and in El Segundo, and we kind of wrapped things up in terms of going forward, and we finished that last month, and that's pretty much it, all we've been doing on the investment governance side. I'll turn it over to staff for the rest.
Okay. As far as fiscal services go, Millennium Solutions, the contract was finalized, and they're actually on site. The plan is to have an assessment for you at the November meeting, so they're moving, they're not messing around. I think it's going to be really productive. We also have the request for proposal for janitorial services went out. Unfortunately, I only received one bid. It's from the people we currently have. We're not totally unhappy with them, so we'll look at it. I haven't decided if I'm just going to try something different or just keep what we have.
Do they know what you're unhappy about?
We weren't happy with the service we were getting, and they cleaned it up. They brought us somebody different. I was getting a lot of complaints.
How many new people have we had here in the last 6 months to a
year? We had the same person for like 3 years, and then all of a sudden it was like a whole bunch of turnover, and we could live with a lot, but quite frankly, we get a lot of calls and concerns from our tenants.
Some of that turnover, though, was because we complained.
Yeah, we complained.
It wasn't just there on their end.
This isn't working, this isn't working. And I had a long conversation with the owner, and he got me somebody different, and now I'm getting raving reviews both from the tenant and our own staff. And the manager came, and he saw what the problems were, and he got on it. And so they cleaned it up. You know, they've gotten their act together. And so I'm not unhappy about that. And our tenants have sent me emails and, oh, she's wonderful, thank you very much because when they have their clients and meetings in and stuff, that's part of our service to them is to provide this. So having them unhappy doesn't help us get our work done.
Who's doing that?
UBS, I think. Mm-hmm. Because we want it done during the day,
Universal Building Services.
I think is what it is. We want it done during the day. We don't want people.
My only concern is when there's only one person responsive. you don't want to get stuck in just re-upping with them if they're not producing.
Well,
but it sounds like they're making some changes.
When we started the process, they were not producing very well, and they definitely turned it around. So
is the process still open or is it closed?
No, the proposals are in. I either have to say thank you very much and start over again or go with them. And I haven't had a chance to talk to Rick about it.
I'm surprised that Pride didn't bid.
You know, I had only two people show up for the walkthrough, and one of them was like 20 minutes late, and so I couldn't take them through the process. So it just sort of, you know, it just didn't work.
Yeah.
And so I think part of it is a day thing, and it's a limited amount of time. I don't know. I just didn't get much, and I know we didn't get much the first go around. So by the board, we pulled most of those funds from the past of BlackRock Real Estate Fund. The rest we had in cash already sitting in, so we pulled it back out again. On the IT side and the benefit staff side, they're very helpful in this. Every year we send a lot of data to our actuaries before they can do their evaluation. I mean, every bit of member data we have, they get. And then they do all kinds of data mining and send it back for questions. Takes quite a bit of time and energy on staff. But we got all that turned around back to them, so we did not hold up their ballot, their evaluation, or their experience to study all of them. And for the first time ever since we've been in place, we don't have to walk over to 10th Street Place to get checks signed anymore. We actually can do that electronically, so our IT staff has been very helpful in putting a few of those nifty tools in place. Before we would walk over and have someone scan the answer to 2015, we finally got. So hey, we're moving forward.
When you get there, they use the stamp anyway.
It's a stamp. Yeah, we finally have it set. We can run it through like we do the payroll. We can get it all in there. We both don't have to walk the checks across anymore. It's really. And then on the very last piece would be the financial audit. You see this critical schedule there. The auditors were on time. The auditors are scheduled to meet with the IBC on November 10th at 1 o'clock with their reports. And then the final capital will go to the board in December. So actually November. So we're moving right ahead on the financial audit. So.
Your turn. Hey, on the member and employer services side, unfortunately, we have two typos in this section I see. So during the month of, that should be September, member and employer services staff process a lot of printouts. We have 59 new hires that we got added into our system, 94 buybacks, and 106 estimates. There were 30 individual counseling sessions and one group presentation at the county's pay dirt meeting, which is an organization of all of the county's payroll clerks, their HR clerks, everyone who is touching all of these forms that need to get to us. And our staff are continuing to update our processes, all of our written processes that we have in place. Both the auditors require this, and because of our project that we have with Linea Solutions, we need to make sure that we have everything updated to give them the most current information of how we're currently doing things. Now, the sad news is that also at the end of September, we said goodbye to Michelle Silva. She was our retired annuitant right here from Samsara, and we were able to use her over the last couple of years, first to help transition the management team, because after everybody retired at the same time, she was a really good resource because she had so many years of service here and had a lot of information to help us with. Then when we started our data conversion file audit process again, she was the lead on that, and we got all of the older files audited.
And so everything through December 31st of 1998 has been audited with the help of Michelle leading the team. Now, that was all of the old stuff where we had to get information off of microfiche and out of old systems, old payroll systems. A lot of it is in old binders that are this long and all kinds of things. So it was very complex information that needed to be collected from a lot of different resources. And Michelle was familiar with all of those. So she took that project and she worked it through, made it to the end of that project, and so that now we have let her go on and actually be retired. So we'll miss her terribly.
Payroll
but
history?
All kinds of payroll history, all the way back to the beginning of, so all of our active employees now, those are the files we were auditing.
How is that different than the research you did for Ventura?
That was looking for specific pay codes, and it was only on the people that had turned in the applications that qualified. This is on every single file.
Universe.
Yes, exactly. And so, because for a technology system to work for us, we have to have good, clean data in there.
Yeah.
And that's the our most difficult area in our data is having accurate service time for our members. So, because it was spread out all over. So every time a person retires, we do manually audit the file, but what we're trying to do is get them all audited so what's in the system will be the best that we have ever had. And so now that process does need to continue because this just got us through December 31st of 1998, not December 31st of 2015. So the next step, the phase two of that process is now starting, which is going to take us from January 1st of 1999 through current. This is when the county went with PeopleSoft, and since the county is the largest employer, this is huge for us because this is when we were able to start collecting more data, and we have so much more available to us in this system. So this part of the process, we're not expecting to have the level of expertise that Michelle Silva had. What we're planning to do is we are hiring a couple of part-time employees. We actually had offered employment to two people. One of them has already accepted a full-time position in another county department. So, but we do have one person who's retiring from the state and has agreed to come to work for us part-time. And so we're going to start auditing those files forward. We're going to have our current staff do the training with them, and hopefully within a couple of weeks we're going to be able to give them enough of the basics and then the resources and the staff to go to that we're going to be able to turn them loose on these files and start getting all of the newer stuff because it should be cleaner data, it should be easier things to research. So moving forward.
Right,
for the county employees. Now we don't have as much data from the other employers, but
small guys.
Mm-hmm. But also remember there are a lot of things like that the employers were not required to give us the data of when it was earned. So all retroactive payments, so anybody who was late on giving a raise or anything like that, all of those retro payments came in one lump sum. Now we need to go back and divvy them up into the right payrolls where they belong, and a lot of that kind of thing happens. So there's still work to be done. The information we have is not perfect, so we are still going through those to do the best that we can, and that's our current project right now going forward on the benefit side. Also, the fact that Linnea is here and we have our staff is working directly with them to give them the information that they need as well.
One thing I can say from a much, much higher level than Don's analysis is that Lenny has been on site for just under 2 weeks now. And they said that we, given what we've done with our data over the last year, we're so far ahead of most systems where we are right now because of the fact we have clean data. And that bad data is one of the biggest causes for error and mistake
and
in implementation
and
failure of
a
system. So I guess what I wanted to say is I wasn't 100% sure a year ago whether we should start down the road of cleaning the data because I didn't know whether there was going to be some other new way of doing this. But the amount of time that we put into this over the year, it seems to be paying off right now.
We also have some of the information in paper files that until somebody manually enters it into the database,
yeah.
It's not there. So again, this is missing out of the database. So there's a lot of manual work still to do, but we're plugging away.
Absolutely.
We're going to go to the CEO and see if we get some money, and hopefully find another person who wants to work part-time for quite a while. But we're thinking 6 months to a year to get this thing done again, with a couple of people.
All right. Item 7C, this is a discussion and action item regarding California Retired County Employees Association semi-annual conferences, and I'm going to give this one to Kelly Gomes.
This is the item that you might remember that Joan asked to be placed on the agenda. It would have been, and it was on our administrative agenda, so that in time for Joan to attend and Michael to attend. But since we didn't have a quorum there, it's on this agenda. So I'm asking for current meeting, the one that they just attended, and then attendance for future. So CRCEA provides a largely amount, it seems, for retiree information, but there is some information for trustees there as well, and it's spelled out in the item.
So there's no risk, and it costs us $90 a year?
No, it seems that for budget-wise, the registration appears to be about $45 for attendees. But the
it's for each. The group only pays once, right?
No, it's
not per person.
It said $45 per attendee.
Per attendee.
And then depending on where the location is how much the expenses are for travel and food. So it's usually pretty local. The two of them have been attending for a while on and off, so they could speak about what
they do. They do in Northern California, the Southern California, generally one of the counties. Like we've hosted it. San Joaquin just hosted it. Sacramento hosted it last year. Next one's going to be in Bakersfield. Fresno will host. Some of the smaller counties won't host. Merced, Imperial, but Orange hosts, I think, in San Diego. And maybe Ventura hosts. But you don't have to go to each and every one of them. We don't necessarily go to each and every one of them.
Exactly.
I am paid for through RESCO. So
you have a motion for us, sir?
Yeah, I would move that we put this on the, add this to our training. Is it training?
Standing training opportunity.
The staff recommendation was to approve or deny trustee attendance to current and future biannual CRCA.
I second it.
The good part about CRCA is it's shorter, it's cheaper, and it's all 37 acts. You don't have to listen to all the first stuff and the first stuff.
Okay.
Okay. We have a motion and a second. We have a motion and a second. Any further discussion?
There's a nice article about it in the
CRCA.
Sacris magazine.
Oh, as a matter of fact, Eve's Cherry showed up at our
official.
Yeah, that's the first time anybody's ever showed.
So. Okay, so the question, all those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay, so moved.
Okay, that brings us to item 7D, fiscal year 2015-2016 budget adjustment for the IT project. This is a discussion and action item, and I will give it over to Kathy Herman.
Okay. On August 12th, the board approved the evaluations team recommendation to accept a proposal from Linea Solutions for a not-to-exceed amount of $277,000. That would take us through the assessment process right up to finding a vendor for a new system if the board should so choose. At the time we did the budget in June, we did not know the numbers. We were in the middle of the RFP process. So. At that time, the board was informed that we would be coming back for budget adjustment if it was approved. So basically, this is a technical adjustment to accept a recommendation and to adjust a budget for the $277,000 for the information technology consulting services. Any questions?
Make a motion to approve.
This is a cleanup issue, by the way. You've already approved this.
We've already approved the contract.
We have a motion.
Aye.
Sorry. Hey, you're in a hurry. Motion and a second. Any further discussion?
No, you've already approved this. It's just that we forgot to ask you to change the budget. That's the only issue.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? So moved.
I saw a look on your face. All right.
7E.
Item 7E. This is a discussion about build out of unfinished space on the sixth floor right here to the west of us. And this is a discussion and action item as well. And Kathy Herman will present this item.
Okay, each of you had a copy of, a draft copy of the plan in front of you when you got here. And basically, this is the space behind us. It's about 900 square feet and potentially could be leased by Raymond James or we could use it ourselves. And originally I was asked by trustees Gordon and Grover to find out what it would cost to build that out into a boardroom. And so I did some research, asked around, and I quickly figured out that because we may own the sixth floor, but the county owns the core and the shell, there's nothing we can do that doesn't involve the county. And we would also have to involve all of the tenants in the building anytime we were to do anything with the electrical system for plumbing or anything else. So getting that kind of work done is going to require some expertise, not just in the government regulations and the bidding process, but construction, which is not my expertise. It's not a capital project for the county, so they wouldn't take it on as a CEO's capital project.
Real simple.
GSA does have a contract employee who is able to help with something about this size. And he came over to look at it, and he says a custom build-out of a boardroom takes a lot of design and a lot of fancy bits and pieces. There's different load requirements. There's some different things that go on. But before you can do the boardroom, you have to finish the walls and the ceiling and everything anyway. So he highly recommended we do a warm vanilla shell build out, which would complete the HVAC system. It would give us some space if we wanted to use it that way. We could either use it for a lease option. If we get the HVAC system completed, we can then hopefully do a true air balancing and whatever adjustment house needs to be done. So we might get some airflow in any of these rooms in a pattern that would work. If Raymond James decided they wanted the space and the board decided to hold off building a boardroom for the lease option, they would have that access as well. So there's lots of really good prudent reasons to do the shell now. Another reason to do it now is it's a smaller project. It's a project we can get done. GSA, we have an agreement with GSA. This would be extra. He would work for by the hour, $31.50 an hour, not to exceed $5,000 total. But he would help me get through this entire RFP process. The contractors in this area know the government RFP process better than anybody in this room. So if you do something wrong or you miss a step, they're going to know it. So I really wouldn't recommend we tackle any type of construction project without expert help.
So for the $50,000 you're asking for, does that give us his services and a projection on the ceiling, lights, air conditioning, painted walls, and carpet?
Yes.
To get a usable.
So we'll have a usable room for $50,000.
Exactly.
Room for
and then we plan on coming back to you later on when we spend more time researching.
For cabinets and seats. And that's
right. Exactly.
Decide if you want, because we're going to need space. If we're going to do this whole project, the board has an option to say no, we're not going to. But if the board says we're going to do the project, probably will. We're going to need space.
Mr. Gordon, did you have something? Yeah.
Somewhere we're going to need some space.
I move that we proceed with staff's recommendation to approve the use of the County General Services to serve as project manager to complete the shell of the remaining 896 square feet of unfinished vacant space on the sixth floor.
Second.
And approve the budget adjustment for the 2015-16 administrative budget to include the $50,000 for the total project.
No, second.
Okay.
All right.
Well,
Jim has a question.
It's just
why was it never built out, or why did Raymond James never take that space when they moved in.
They didn't want that much space when they moved in, and at the time, the board basically felt, get us a tenant, but the space was being absolutely not utilized at all. Right. They had talked about expanding at some point in time into that space, but there's only 4 or 5 people over there.
So when they moved, when they originally moved in here, they did come around and were kicking our tires about that place over there, but they kind of quickly dropped interest, I think, after that.
And didn't they pay for their TIs?
Yes.
So why pay for that when you don't really need it now?
Yes, and that was part of the way
the contract was written. Stick you with it, because it's either you use it or they use it, otherwise it's...
Yeah, it's just sitting there, and the TIs, the way that contract was put together, we used Terry Rain, who is a very knowledgeable attorney on the contract, on the construction projects in this area of the building, so we could do this and they could get in.
We have a motion and a second. Any further questions, discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay, so moved.
Okay, item 7F. This is a discussion and action item regarding the investigation of an individual holding within the White Oak portfolio. Staff's recommendation today is we're going to be asking you whether to we need to go back and to research an investment within the White Oak portfolio. So let me give you just a 2-minute update on what this item is about. In September, Trustee Ford asked staff to research an investigative demand that was being done by the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau regarding a firm called regarding an employee that works for a firm called Partner Weekly, which is a subsidiary of Selling Source, which is an investment we actually own within the White Oak portfolio. This is just a civil investigative demand. There's been no allegations of any sort yet. I've been told that these investigations are not that uncommon. But let me give you just a little bit of background on the investment itself. Stansair is approximately has approximate 10% interest in the White Oak Fund. As of March 31st, Selling Source, which is the investment in question, was worth about $49 million, which means that Stansair owns about $4.9 million of that investment. The loan that was given to Selling Source is set to refund in about 15 months, so January 31st, 2017. The game plan is that loan will be refunded and we would be out of that investment at that time. The loan itself is paying 12.5% coupon and it has a projected internal rate of return of 14%. So as you may recall, Trustee Ford has had several inquiries into Selling Source itself. He has sent 2 letters to White Oak. White Oak has responded once in writing, twice verbally before the board on specifically Selling Source, although I don't think this Partner Weekly investment was ever discussed in general when White Oak responded. It was just about the Selling Source investment as a whole. So I reached out to Ed. We talked about this a lot. We believe that if there is an issue with an investment within a manager's portfolio, that this needs to be brought up at the manager level and not digging down into the weeds and looking at individual investments by themselves. I also, to feel a little better about this request or about what my recommendation is going to be, I reached out to our investment counsel and I specifically asked him the question, does this board or organization have a fiduciary responsibility or duty to investigate individual holdings within a manager's portfolio? His response was no, unless there is an obvious violation of the law and no one is doing anything about it. Both of those conditions are not met in this situation right here. First of all, there has not been an obvious violation of the law. It's only an investigative demand. And second, there is somebody doing something about it. That's the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. So putting all that together, my recommendation, I have a feeling Ed would concur, is that we really do nothing on this matter and we let the civil investigation take its course and see what happens. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Don't you need action, though? That implies that we just don't need action.
You could probably just not do anything. That'd probably be okay. But actually, I'd rather have it.
I think it would be better if we gave staff direction.
I would rather have it on record, yes.
Absolutely.
Well, and I think it also begs the broader question of whether, because this item right here, Trustee Ford was asking specifically to have work done and investigations done. Should that come to the whole board, or can a trustee just?
I don't think we want a single board member giving staff direction.
Well, that would incur cost.
I agree. Right. But so, I mean, that's why I think we should discuss that we would want any item, regardless of who it came from, to come to the whole board.
The question I have for the board is, does anybody on the board think that we should go forward with this? Think that we should authorize staff to spend money?
No.
To do this?
No.
Okay.
I think this is Gordon's issue.
Yeah. Okay, so we seem to be in agreement with that. Now beyond that, how would you want a motion framed that would...
That you direct staff not to go forward with this legal research.
Do we want to broaden that to include...
Let me hold on.
At this point.
I was going to bring this up. I think this brings up a bigger issue, because as I was writing this agenda item, what you suggested really came clear to me, widescreen. I think what we're going to do is next month we're going to bring an item to you, because we had this question when Trustee Ford asked us to do something to Members Forum. We asked ourselves, okay, do we need to go back to the board and ask them whether they want us to do this research, or should we just do it and so forth? I think what we need to do is we need to come up with a policy. When somebody asks for something in Members Forum, the question is not to, we don't want to go spend a lot of time spinning our wheels and coming back to you. We just want to come back the next meeting and say, do you want us to do this? Because we don't believe that we can discuss whether we can do it in Members Forum, because it hasn't been agendized.
It becomes an agenda item for the next meeting.
Exactly. Just the concept of whether you want us to progress just like we did today. So we're going
to... So he wrote a letter directly to White Oak. What was the impact of that action to San Sarah?
So...
I mean, did we have to engage Fred and the other attorneys?
No.
And he has a right to do that.
Absolutely. Okay. Absolutely. And White Oak has addressed it twice in front of us. And I don't...
And he's doing the research then. It's not costing us anything.
Right.
If he wants to run around and do all this research and that kind of stuff... Hey,
so
good for him.
Is there a policy statement you'd like to make at this time, or do we just vote?
I'd like to bring that at a later date.
So I would move that we not engage on an investigation of this item.
Yeah. Partner Weekly, a subsidiary of Selling Source within our White Oak book.
Yeah. And I would second that.
Okay. Any further discussion?
Do we know what kind of returns we're getting on that?
Yes, actually, I did look at that, and as of 3/31, their numbers, not mine, their numbers, it was 11%, somewhere in the neighborhood of 11%.
How much of it's been refunded at this point?
None of it so far. So well, they're paying coupons, but none of the principal.
We get our principal back in January of 17.
That's the game plan. Correct.
Hopefully.
Okay.
We should invest in anything that makes us money. Not get involved in this politically correct.
Well, and that's really, I think, what this boils down to, but we are going to have this discussion on the 16th of December at the Asset Liability Study.
Anything that's legal and makes us
money.
There you go.
You know, if you look at CalPERS, I mean, they're into the politically correct investments. And
social investing.
Invest in oil companies or coal companies, and they invest in stuff that doesn't make any money, like solar energy. We don't want to be like that. That's why our returns are always higher than theirs.
Okay. So.
I just don't think we need to go there.
Okay. So we have a motion and a second.
I might have to pay loan myself.
All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
Come see me first, Jim.
All right.
Thank you.
Item 7G, this is the last item on the executive director part of the agenda. This is a discussion and action item regarding SACR's legislative proposals. There will be two proposals that will be up for discussion on the Friday business meeting on the 20th, of which Michael is our first delegate and Sam is our second delegate there. And so what we're going to do is I'm just going to give you a brief rundown of these two proposals that they're going to be asking you to vote on, and we'd like to get some input from the board on how to direct Mike and Sam to vote at these proposals. The first one is the most interesting one. You know, let me take the second one first, because it's pretty much a no-brainer. They're asking for legislation that would make it not mandatory to collect sworn statements from new members. Right now, that law that's on the book is from 1947, and so we're required, systems are required to collect sworn statements regarding certain information about themselves when they become members. And now what this legislation simply says is that let us use the data that we get from our plan sponsors as validation in lieu of the sworn statement. It does not preclude systems from continuing to collect sworn statements if they want. It only gives them the option to not have to do it. So that's the first one. The second one is a little more interesting. There is proposed, Sackers wants to put proposed legislation on the books that would allow any 1937 Act system to become an independent system on their own. Now, you can always do that right now. However, there's a lot involved to becoming independent right now. You have to go out and seek somebody to promote legislation for, a sponsor that would promote legislation for you in Sacramento. You have to craft legislation that specifically is adaptive to your own situation. A lot of systems only want to be able to control a certain number of employees' salaries and benefits, whereas other systems want to be able to control the entire organization's salary and benefits. So this would give pretty much anybody the ability to adopt that new part of the code section and become independent. I don't know how much more I want to get into it. I do have some thoughts on it, but I guess what I would tell you, which makes this maybe a little more interesting, is that there are, I think, exactly the same number of code sections in on the books right now as there are independent systems. This is always seems to be a controversial issue for the county, particularly the county and the retirement system. It's very contentious. So I don't have an opinion one way or another, but I do want you to know that these are issues, these are contentious issues between the county and the systems, and I don't know what the implications are by just throwing this law on the books and letting the retirement systems do what they want without going through, you know, the hard knocks process, I guess, of what it takes to actually become independent. That's my 2 cents worth, that this is not, it may be written and seem like a slam dunk issue, but there's a lot more going on behind the scenes regarding this type of legislation. So we're asking you to direct the voting delegate on how to vote on these issues. And
even if this passed, so doesn't the county have to authorize it?
I don't know. They're not giving us any language.
Oh, okay.
They're just really kind of giving us very little.
Why would we vote yes on something we don't have language for?
I agree. I mean, that's kind of what I'm thinking too. But I don't want to steer you guys in the wrong way. I truly, truly don't, because I am not an expert here and I don't know. But it seems like there's a lot missing with this legislative worksheet proposal that's attached. And that's all we have.
That's all you got?
That's all I got. So, you know, maybe the thing is you guys need to listen to what's going on with you there and, I don't know, figure out, judge for yourselves.
Ask good questions.
I don't know that the counties themselves actually ever voted. I believe that they had to get legislation passed and the voters had to vote, because in order to turn into a special district, which is what they turn into, they had to follow all the rules and regs it takes to become a special district. So I don't think the county necessarily votes to let them go.
So, for instance, there was a threat of a lawsuit between Contra Costa County and the retirement system for their wanting to go independent. So the point is that these things aren't as easy.
But the reason they were having an issue, my understanding is, in Contra Costa, they were having an issue attracting a CEO,
right?
Because
and they couldn't pay him.
They couldn't pay him enough. Because of the county's restrictions, exactly. On what they're
and the county and the county didn't want to cave, so they essentially battled this out, and they finally agreed the solution was to go independent.
No, that was Contra Costa. And that was a problem, and that's going to continue to be a problem in the future as funds get bigger, and you need a CIO, and you know, these guys that were sitting here today make a lot of money, and you bring somebody in and say we're going to pay you $90,000 to manage, you know, $2 billion, they're going to laugh at you.
Yeah, my only point is that there just doesn't seem to be enough here.
Oh, yeah. No, this is pretty vague.
There's more usually going on behind the scenes with these types of issues.
do that.
So do you have a recommendation for us, Rick, or?
No, I don't. Yes, I just want you to know my reservations on that issue. The other one, I think you should just go ahead and, it's just, there's no reason not to endorse the other one, the sworn statement one. But maybe, like I said, direct them to learn a little more while they're there and make a more informed decision.
Well, you probably don't know the answer to this either. There are three or four independent boards now. Do they get to vote on this item? They're already independent.
That's a good question. I don't know.
It makes no difference to them. Interesting.
I wish I could offer you more, but I just, there's nothing there.
Okay.
Somebody wants to talk
to you. So I'll make a recommendation of or a motion for support of the employee sworn statements.
I'll second that.
Okay. Motion and a second. Discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay, so moved.
That gets us off the table on that one now. So that we can move on. What do we want to do on this first one?
What's your pleasure? Would we abstain on this?
You can abstain.
We can abstain. Yeah. As opposed to a yes or a no.
You're going to be the one that's going to be
delegated. Well, I'll do whatever the board... You know, if they want me to abstain, I'll abstain.
You would attend the legislative meeting, right?
Yeah.
Well, part of it would be to say, hey, there's not enough information.
Well, yeah, that's the thing. This might have to be put over if enough people say, hey, we don't know what we're voting on.
Should that be our motion then, that Michael representatives at the pre-meeting and let them know that we won't be voting on it until we have details?
That's definitely an option.
And that our choice is to abstain.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't think we have enough to go on here.
Okay.
There, you got your marching orders.
Yeah, good.
Do we need a second for that motion, or is that just enough for Michael to go on?
I think you need a motion.
Okay.
So I move that position of abstention.
Okay.
I'll second that as well.
Okay, we have a motion and a second. Discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
I'm going to abstain.
Okay. Is that a conflict? Okay, where are we now? We are at Ferris. Ed?
Yes.
Good afternoon, everyone. So we have two topics I'd like to cover with you today. One is the monthly summary of performance. Take a look at September numbers, and then when I come back in November, we'll be talking about the third quarter overall in much more detail. And then we'll get into the current state assessment, a separate handout that you have. But before I do that, I want to quickly update you on our organizational announcement that came out about a week ago, and that was that Verus has effectively acquired SIS, which is your former consultant, and this deal is being structured as a merger. So this will now give us presence in a number of ways. One, it'll take our employee headcount up above 100. We were right around 77, 78. 23 folks from SIS will be joining our team, assuming all goes well and the deal closes at the end of December, beginning of January. Some change in ownership because it's both a cash and stock transaction, so some of the SIS owners will become owners of the new combined Verus, as well as some of the Verus employees will have an opportunity to participate in ownership as well. So that's all good. This will also raise our profile with a number of public plans because, as I'm sure you're aware, SIS has a several large states, and so that will further increase our ability to serve public pension plans, which I think is going to be a great benefit and something that I hope benefits you guys directly and the participants. And then it will also benefit our research team. So they have a number of great investment folks there, which we're excited to have join our investment research capabilities. And we're not anticipating any layoffs or fires or anything like that, no reduction in headcount. So we view this all as very great upside for both sides. So we're pretty excited about that. Let me pause there, see if there are any questions.
Is SIS still going to be where they're going to be located?
Yes, still in San Francisco, keeping the San Francisco office open. And continuing with that. In fact, we had one person in San Francisco who was working out of his house. he'll now have an office. So.
Is that a space issue?
We have. Will there be any account relationship or management changes in the future?
Great question. None anticipated. And as you know, it's very difficult for consultants to change the relationships. So not only are there none anticipated, we think that it would be very difficult to do. And in fact, we just are looking to stabilize their existing base and make sure that they understand what the organization in total looks like and get to know us a little bit. Their contracts will have to novate over to Varis from SIS. The Varis existing agreements, like what we have with you, stays in place, no changes needed. And then the question about management, it will be the existing Varis management team taking on responsibilities there. So by and large, that will take place. And then key personnel there, we've had discussions with them in terms of, as you know, Michael Beasley's departure was part of what preceded this. And then the remaining crew will become members of our investment committee, members of our management committee. So they'll be contributing to the management process. Okay, great. Let's dive into performance then. I think you have a two-page handout, which we're going to try to get the font even smaller next time, but for this time, this is really large. I know. We'll try to fix that. They get a little tough to read as we get more and more data crammed onto two pages. But as we mentioned at our last update, we tend to do a deeper dive on our quarterly updates, so we'll take a quick view of what we're seeing in the fund on a one-month and year-to-date basis. You're seeing that the month of September was down 2.7% in aggregate for the plan, bringing year-to-date numbers down 4.2% and underperforming the index. We'll take a look at why that is. And really, you can see it on the right-hand side with this bar chart. As you compare the current versus policy, you can see that we're overweighted domestic equities, 45% versus policy at 38%. And that's the key contributor to the drawdown relative. So why we have the negative 4.2% versus our index at negative 2.9%. We also have a slight overweight to international equities, which is represented in green, and then the underweight to fixed income. And you can imagine in a down market like this, the fixed income was a flight to safety and did relatively stronger. As we take a look through the investment strategies themselves, you'll see some interesting notes. One is that almost all of our active managers underperformed for the month. Kind of odd to see that, but Jackson Square you're seeing down 3.7%. versus its index at down 2.5%. Dodge and Cox, equity underperformed. Legato and Capital Prospects all underperformed for the month. Dodge and Cox is still ahead of its benchmark for a year-to-date basis, as is Capital Prospects. And what's also interesting is as you take a look at this and think about your large cap value, core, and growth exposures, you see that core actually outperformed both of those. So when you take a look, for example, at the Russell 1000 value was down 3%. I'm sorry, Russell 1000 growth actually outperformed, down 2.5%. Value was down 3%, and the S&P 500 itself was down 2.5%. On the international equity side, and this ties into a lot of the headlines you've been hearing about China and the slowdown there, we have LSV down 5%, also underperforming its index. Pyramus actually outperformed, which was nice, but still down 4.4%. On the fixed income side, Dodge and Cox and PIMCO both underperformed the Barclays Ag, and Dodge and Cox has more credit exposure. Credit is a little bit riskier, and that's why it's hurt. PIMCO is more broadly diversified, and it did outperform Dodge and Cox, but still didn't do quite what the index did, as it was underweight treasuries. As we take a look on page 2, on the real estate side, a number of these are essentially blank or basically blank. So when we look at the prime property fund, and when we look at the direct lending investments and the MS infrastructure, all of these do not report on a monthly basis, so we don't have data there. Similarly, American Strategic Value Realty has a zero for it. Truth be told, that's not available data. That's the 630 data carried forward. So what we really have is the BlackRock U.S. real estate at a positive 3.3%. Now, since then, we've seen a pretty noticeable rebound in October. So let me share some of those numbers with you. And this is through October 22nd. Month to date, through the 22nd, the S&P 500 is up 7%. The Russell 2000 is up 5%. And the AQUI index, so global, is up 7%. U.S. aggregate for the fixed income portfolio up about 0.6%. Credit up 1%. High yield up 2.6%. Commodities basically flat. And REITs up 8.1%. So REITs have been the place to invest so far.
How long is that going to last for the REITs? I'm watching those too. I don't understand why they're going up the way they are.
Yeah, you know, REITs tend to trade a lot like small cap stocks, and they tend to exhibit that kind of volatility. So when we see that coming up like that, we take it with a grain of salt, with the expectation that it's probably overstated and it'll probably come back, or it's rebounding because it went down too far in the first place. So it's more that volatility. Long term, it should trend with real estate, which has been a much more stable investment overall.
What's the firm's opinion on active versus passive management?
Globally?
Yeah.
So we do an annual review of active versus passive. And what we do in that review is we take a look at all asset classes and dissect it and say, what makes sense here? Let's see what the numbers show it and prove it out. And historically, we've looked at it and said, you know, the pockets that are more efficient, like U.S. large cap value or U.S. large cap core, is better to get an indexed exposure. You really can't outperform over long term, and if you do, you're not going to compensate for the fees. Similarly on fixed income, we've looked at that and said fixed income, the BC aggregate is the main index that portfolio managers managing core and core plus strategies use. They can easily outperform that because the aggregate it has a huge weighting in U.S. treasuries. And you can step a little bit out the risk spectrum in mortgage backs and other asset-backed securities and outperform nicely. But now we're seeing that those numbers are actually trending differently. And so what we've done is we've taken a look, and our analysis, I can bring it to you next quarter, is using what we have as cloud perspectives on it. So rather than just saying individual points for individual asset classes, this one outperforms, this one doesn't, this one does, this one doesn't, we started developing clouds that show the dispersion around that and how all the managers in that universe cluster. And then we take that and compare that to the index and see where the index falls inside that cloud. And if the majority of that cloud is lower standard deviation, lower volatility with higher return, you're probably better off actively managing it. So our perspectives have changed a bit. So some of the things, like I said, in the U.S. space, large cap core makes a lot of sense. Small cap is a mixed bag. Some managers can outperform there. Internationally, we like active management across the international spectrum, both developed and emerging markets, because having the ability to choose which countries to be in and how much to be in them is an important decision to be made, as well as which stocks you're owning in those countries. Fixed income, tend to see more active management across the board in fixed income. Real estate, active. Commodities, almost always active, because when we look at the commodities benchmarks, they're fundamentally flawed and easily traded against. And so when you see something like that, it's just kind of a no-brainer.
Thanks.
You're welcome. Okay, let's take a look at the current state assessment. So this is the next step that we had outlined for this onboarding exercise, what's leading to an investment strategy development. And what this document really is designed to do is to show where the plan is today. Let's just get a comprehensive understanding of it. Let's get all on the same page and make sure we understand all of the facts together. And so the executive summary gives you a quick thumbnail of what we see and what each of these sections does. If we turn to page 6, we get into the plan characteristics. So numbers you're all very familiar with. But it's interesting to see the top, the market value of assets has grown at a 3-year and 6-year annualized growth rates of 8.1 and 5.4%. And these numbers are a little different than your performance numbers because your performance numbers are really driven by the performance of the strategies. These take into account cash flows, and so how fast is that asset base growing or shrinking over time? So a 3-year annualized growth rate of 8.1% is pretty nice growth, in excess of our actuarial assumed liabilities and or assumed discount rate, and therefore allowing the funded ratio to improve, which you can see in the orange line. So now we're up to about 88% using the 7.75%.
On page 7, we have the plan cash flows. And what we show here are two different metrics. One, looking at the operating cash flows, which is to say contributions coming in versus benefits and expenses going out. And you can see the orange line here, net operating cash outflow. And so how do we make that up? Well, we've been fortunate by having positive investment income in excess of that outflow. So on the right-hand side, when we add in the investment income, you can see that that orange line is consistently positive. And so we really do have a reliance on this investment income to keep us afloat. On page 8, we have some participant statistics. So just quick schematic, making sure we understand the payrolls and our demographics and what we're dealing with here. And so on the left-hand side, we have the participant trends. The actives in the blue line, we see the decrease from 2008 to 2010, and now on a slightly positive trajectory going forward, so it looks like the actives are increasing. Retirees is the maroon line, and you can see that that has the steepest slope here, so that's increasing the fastest. Inactives, and then the difference in the orange bars. And so we have that. The note at the bottom is saying the declining number of active participants should eventually lead to a decline in growth rate of retired participants, but that's based on the linear assumption of the actives, and actually that appears to be increasing now in the most recent periods. So while overall it has decreased, I think if we look more recently, it looks like that number is on the uptick. Let's turn to the asset allocation of the plan on page 10. Here we run the asset allocation that we currently have through what we call a mean variance analysis. And we take the exposures on the left-hand side, actual and policy, noting that they are somewhat different. And we add in the average pension plan, which is basically to say it's sort of a 60-40 asset allocation, where you have 60% in equities. And here you would see that 45% of it is in domestic and international, and we get another portion of it in private equity, liquid alts, and roughly 60%. And then the other portion in fixed income, 35%, and also some alternatives, real estate, commodities, and so on. And on the right-hand side, you see the results of the analysis. The actual has a forecasted 10-year return using our capital market assumptions of 6.1%. And the policy is at about 6%, and the average pension slightly higher, 6.4. Now, on a 10-year number, 6.1 versus 6.0 is a bit deceiving. The decimal point isn't really that accurate. We don't have that kind of accuracy in looking 10 years forward. So they're roughly the equivalent, average pension slightly higher. The next line below that is standard deviation, though, and we're looking at actual of 11.5% standard deviation versus policy at 10.6 and average pension at 10.7. So, okay, the average pension has slightly higher returns, slightly lower risk built into it. And then you see some other interesting statistics. Two lines down from that, it says first percentile return 1 year, which is basically a measure of drawdown risk. How much could we expect to lose in 1 year if we're in the bottom percentile?
So that means 99% of all the returns are greater than that number.
Yes,
okay.
That's a good way
expected
of interpreting it. Expected, yes. So a one-year worst-case scenario, if you will, is we could lose 29% with our current policy. And average pension isn't much ahead, 26.7. And then sharp ratios, just combine those metrics. And then we have a scenario analysis where we take a look at how the portfolio would do in different economic regimes, if you will, stagflation, if we're in a weak economy, if we're in the base case where we expect mild growth and low inflation, or a strong economy, stronger growth and continued low inflation. And you can see how we would do through each of those scenarios, what the range of the forecast is, and again, an economic shock, which is another way of measuring downside risk. So it starts to give you a sense of when we talk about risk in a portfolio, we're really thinking about preserving capital and preserving capital because we know we have to meet benefit payments today and well into the future. So we want to be very attentive to what our downside exposures are.
I'm just going to go on record and say this is what I've been asking for. And it's amazing that in one meeting you're able to provide this information.
Great.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
This is what
yes.
we asked SIS for several times. So
Once you get them folded into your shop, can you show them this?
See what we can do. On page 11, we have the portfolio allocation in a different way. So we're showing it by asset class on the left-hand side. And then on the right-hand side, we're showing how the risk from each asset class contributes to the whole. And so the actual, we're looking at this 11.5% standard deviation, which I'm looking at the chart on the right, bottom right, with the left-hand side there, which that 11.5 ties up to the page above. And you can see where the risk comes from. We are predominantly geared by the domestic equity exposure in the black bar, and then the light blue international equity, and then a smaller contribution from domestic fixed income in orange, and then hardly anything from the rest. And as we look at the average pension on the right, you can see that the bars are a little bit more diversified, though not highly more diversified, but a little bit more, and you're starting to see greater presence of private equity in this more, let's call it royal blue. And you're starting to see real estate, a sliver of that, hedge funds in green, and commodities in black, or what is that, navy blue at the top. And that's interesting to us because when we think about risk and where it's coming from, we'd rather have our risk come from many baskets so that we have diversified our risks. So even if we have the same risk between two portfolios, the one that is more diversified is likely to give us a better downside scenario, knowing that we're not going to have, expecting that we're not going to have all of the asset classes crash at the same time. 2008 certainly challenged that assumption, but it still has merit there, even in the 2008. And page 12 is just another pictorial representation of that, showing how our actual and policy is weighted much heavier to the domestic equity side, whereas the average pension is more diversified. The next section on risk exposures takes a different slice of this. And what we see on 14 is a concept that instead of thinking about where our risk comes from in terms of asset classes, equities, fixed income, and real estate, etc., let's think about it in terms of risk factors. And the reason why we look at factors is because factors can affect multiple asset classes at the same time. So you can imagine that if rates go up tomorrow, fixed income is going to be impaired. Yep. What's going to happen to equities? They're going to have some sensitivity. What's going to happen to TIPS? They're going to have some sensitivity. What's going to happen to real estate? It's going to have some sensitivity. And so when you look at it from a factor perspective, then you realize that these economic factors can have a real impact on what's going to happen to your portfolio. So what we're showing in this chart here is that the equity exposure that we have, even though we only have combined, call it 65% exposure to the equity asset class, our risk is 94% from equity because the volatility of equities is so great relative to the volatility of fixed income that when you put the portfolio together, our up and down swings are really guided by the up and down swings of equities. Just a fact. So that's what we're showing there, and you can see how that compares to the average pension at 83%. Now, 83% still feels high. So the question is, well, is the difference between 94 and 83 that much different? And yeah, it really can be. And 83 is a whole lot different than 72 or 65. So these numbers, we're always going to see a high number come from equity. We need to have that because we're trying to grow a portfolio of assets over time. So we know that. We're accepting that risk. That's part of what we do. But we want to have it in the right control, and we want to set our expectations appropriately. So should a 2008 event come along again, we know what we're in for, and we don't want to be surprised by that. So we're going to be working with you over the next several months to start showing these kinds of things where we can start having debate about what's the right exposure here. Are we too heavy on equity? Are we too light on fixed income or whatever other asset classes? So this is just an introduction so you can see how your current portfolio looks.
Does any of this have R94? Understand that it's coming from equities. Is it because we're so short in duration on fixed income that that's not a bigger aid in the down market on the equities?
It is. It's a combination. Absolutely. So as you weight more to the equity side, you're pulling out of fixed income effectively, mm-hmm. whether you're consciously making that decision or not. That's right. Effectively what's
happening. And our duration on the fixed income.
Right. On page.
Interest rates going up tomorrow?
We do not.
Tomorrow?
So the Fed's meeting now, so they're going to come up with something.
We do not, and, you know, more and more, what we're hearing on rates is that they've either missed their opportunity, they could have earlier this year with the cover of stronger economic data and before China came out with its news. But because of what we're seeing around the world and what we're experiencing here in the U.S., with a lot of the consumer numbers that are coming out, the economic statistics just aren't as strong. We're okay, but just not as strong. That they don't have the room to do it. That's what we think, but you know, sure, as soon as I say that, I'll be wrong. So, you know, expect it.
Water has been wrong for a decade.
Right, right. Everybody's been waiting for rates to rise and just hasn't happened.
I've heard, I think, for the last 2 years that the rates are going to rise 0.25%. Yeah, it's just never happened. And 0.25% is not much anyway.
Yeah.
I've never seen things so stagnant.
I think it's been 10 years since the Fed has raised rates. I think I heard that recently. Is that right? Mm-hmm. You heard that too? Yeah. It's amazing. Page 15 takes, and we'll get into some others as well. Page 15 takes the portfolio and does a stress test. And these are interesting stress tests where we take an individual variable and we see what happens to the portfolio when we stress that one variable. So here we're showing at the top the U.S. dollar appreciates 20%. What happens to the rest of the portfolio? Global equities decline by 20%. Global credit spreads, global rates increase. And so through each of these scenarios, we get some idea of the sensitivity. And this is mainly a comparison in terms of how else we can be positioned. So here we're just, again, showing it against the average pension plan. And no. And so here we generally see that if global equity decreases because we have so much equity exposure, that's the one that's going to hurt us the most. Page 16, then, takes us through historical scenarios. So, okay, if any one of those events happens, that's nice, but in reality, they never happen just individually. Everything else kind of works together in the economy. And so this takes a look at that. And where we see our current portfolio outperforming is in the strong up markets. So on the left-hand side at the top, 2009, July to January, we outperform there. At the very bottom, 1997 to 99 oil price decline, we outperform there. Every one of the other scenarios, we are either neutral or down. And so that gives us raises a concern in terms of how we deal with a downside event, subprime mortgage, .com slowdown,
but over this period of time, I mean, just to look at the lines, we're mostly under.
That's
if
right.
I'm reading that correctly.
That's right.
It's because of a lack of diversification out of equities and fixed income.
We've right. done well over the last 3 or 4 years because of our equity exposure.
Because, right, the last 5 years, right. equity markets, the capital markets have done very well.
But overall, since 1997.
But in more normal market conditions. No, not the Fed. It's just, you know, private equity and mm-hmm. other real assets around the globe.
Real estate has done very well. Real estate is another interesting asset class where we continue to see really strong demand in terms of institutional investors waiting to invest more there. We had a question come up from a client about, wow, you know, the China slowdown looks like it's hitting the markets pretty heavily, and that kind of volatility is rippled through. How's that going to play out in real estate? I said, that's a good question. Let's take a look at that. And I actually found a research piece from one of the real estate managers that was showing that the Chinese investors, as a result of the volatility, are investing in safer assets, and that's part of what's driving real estate values.
Well, real estate is a tangible, for the most part. You know, and it's the mentality of it. You know, if you want to hold on to something, it's got to be real estate, whereas stocks is some elusive idea somewhere, even though it is a tangible, but it's not something you hold in your hand or you could stand on.
Right.
And in our mind's eye, that's still, it's kind of like a historic mindset. Thousands and thousands of years. Exactly.
So as we progress, next few key steps are like an asset liability study, which we're working towards, and an investment strategy development workshop, where I'd really like to have all of us spend a good day off-site. spending some time thinking about these. We're conducting the trustee interviews today and tomorrow. Part of this is all going to feed in. Part of what I'm hearing today is going to feed in. Start thinking about how to efficiently, effectively construct a portfolio that meets the goals and make sure that we have a shared understanding of what those goals are. The last piece here, investment managers, I think it's more of a convenience for each of you, you know, to the extent that you need a handy reference. Page 18 just has an outline of where we're currently invested. And then we have a one-pager on each strategy. So take, for example, Jackson Square. On page 19, we just heard from them. You know, what's the role in the portfolio? What is it we seek to have them do? A couple of the firm details, the inception and the strategy details, their headquarters, expected estimated annual expense ratio. Key people is always a focus. It's always funny to us whenever we have a departure from a firm, and 2 years later, that person was the most important part of this strategy, and when they leave the firm, no, they didn't really do that much. They're good, but they only contributed. Well, it's good to have it on paper as a reference point. The philosophy and the process, which we have outlined for each of the publicly traded managers, and then we have the privates at the back with less return detail, because these are really strategies we've made the commitment to invest in. We really can't get out of them until the contract matures and everything, and the performance that you're going to see is more on IRR and multiple of invested capital. So a little bit different set of metrics there.
So we're going to use this like a textbook for these next meetings going up?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah, absolutely. And then the finches. Madam Chair, that concludes my report.
Thank you. I'm sorry I'm going to miss the asset liability study.
So is today your last official meeting?
I'm going to try to make it to the 24th, but it could be.
November 24th.
Yes. I'm actually headed to Spain in a week or so.
Yes.
Yeah. Maybe my last vacation for a while.
Don't say that. Keeps you
sane. Does it now? Thank you.
Do we need to go to closed session?
Yeah, do we have anything? Okay. Thank you, Ed.
Yes.
Do we have a motion to go into closed session?
I move that we move to closed session.
I'll second.
Motion and a second. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Closed session. All right. We're back.
And you reinforcing that.
Yeah. Sound it's easier for us when
sound effects.
The audio.
Okay, that takes us. Oh, you're going to report out.
No, there's nothing to report.
Okay. Alrighty. Nothing?
No. Nothing.
Okay. So, members forum. Congratulations.
Thank you. A little earlier than I had planned, but okay.
So, practice new, run.
New skills. Right on the horizon. Nothing else from
me. Nothing from me.
I wanted to ask about the suspension of the quarterly newsletter. Is that just because the staff busy?
Yeah, pretty much. We just don't have the resources right now to continue. You know what? In the future, I think we'll be able to go back down that path, but right now it's just not a priority.
You want to volunteer? To write something.
Actually, I have an article in mind.
Oh, there you go.
And that's why you caught my attention.
Solicit.
I will be here at the next meeting, but not the meeting the week of Thanksgiving.
There's only one.
That is our next meeting.
That's it.
Meeting.
Oh, I thought there was.
No, you're not on the GC, are you?
No.
No.
I will not be here during the week of Thanksgiving meeting.
We'll see you the 16th of December.
Okay.
Only one meeting in December.
Yes, and it's at Seasons too, by the
so
way.
So we have one in November and one in December.
Oh, it is.
Mm-hmm. Why would it be at
Seasons? Because the asset liability. We're going to do everything in one day. We're going to feed
I'm
you.
I'm prepared.
And then next year.
Sleep well the night before, Jim.
I don't have anything for members forum.
Thank you, Jim.
I don't have anything either. When was the next meeting in November?
The 24th, here.
Oh. Jim, you did have an IGC on the. But I was informed that you were not available.
What's an IGC?
Internal governance.
The auditors will be.
The internal stuff.
But the meeting, there's not a meeting after that.
But that's on November 10th. Yeah, one of our, we had a meeting planned for 8 months. And one of our board members said, I just can't make it. So we had to rearrange everybody's schedule, staff and everything for this meeting. It's for him. That's why I can't make it.
It's the bright and powerful.
Okay, so the board meeting on the 16th of December will start at 2.
No,
what time is that?
9 o'clock.
No, but I don't have to attend that part of it, do I?
The asset liability
That's
study.
What I mean. So what time will the board
Well, we
meeting
haven't
start?
Decided. We haven't decided that yet. I'll let you know as soon as I can. Everybody else has to come at 9, but we're not sure how we're going to set the order.
Okay.
Don't eat breakfast before.
Depends on
how
you're doing
your negotiations. Okay. I'll put it down for 2, but I'll wait for you guys to come.
Mike?
Two things. One, I went to that Opal conference, and I just want people to let them know or get feedback when you go to the Opal conference in January. This conference, they changed the format a little bit, and they had these sessions called one-on-ones, which were basically sales sessions, which I didn't attend. But, you know, you go in, and then you could sit there and talk to individuals about their products, which didn't interest me at all. The other thing, though, there was a guy there on from our post communications, and he was talking about secure internal email. And I have an acquaintance through CRCA, worked in Sacramento, who's also a realtor. They were doing a real estate transaction with a guy in Oregon, and they were sending emails back and forth, and they sent their the thing for the bank.
Account information?
Yeah, for, you know, the bank transfer, the wire transfer in an email. Somebody intercepted that.
Oh, wow.
$80,000 disappeared, and they couldn't find it. The bank said, hey, we have your instructions, and, you know, that's what we did. But there was a glitch. Somebody got it and changed one digit in that, and it disappeared. And this guy from our post said that they have a product to encrypt your personal email stuff, or, you know, or for a company or agency like ours. Just an interesting idea.
Well, we do all our transmittals through the web portal.
Okay.
Northern Trust.
Yeah, okay. So they're good.
The Chinese
will
read your email.
Sam? Don?
Just a little bit of information. Staff did contact MID and got a quote of about $150,000 to bury the lines in the alley.
Wow, what a difference.
So we could maybe someday get the windows washed. Again, the county owns the building. So we did contact the county, and they have told us they absolutely don't currently have funding in place set aside for a project of this size. But they have agreed to add it to their capital improvement plan so that we can start this process, get it on the 12th Street Management Committee. They can get some funding in place so we can start working towards doing this. And we explain to them that every single time we go to clean the windows, we're going to have to do this $20,000 to $30,000 just to get scaffolding in place. Then it started making way more sense to them. So it's going to take a while, but we are slowly.
Next fiscal year.
Well, I was going to say.
Next fiscal year.
16, 17.
Least, you know, before we get it, but at least we're finally got on the radar and on the right list, I think. So.
And that's a hard quote. That price, am I?
No, we'll have to get another quote again because it'll expire by then.
Inflation.
It'll be expired by then.
And honestly, another concern of the county is that's the MID piece of it. And until they do their own research and whatever they're going to do, what else is included? You know, if there's some other thing that we aren't aware of. So they have to get together. They have to do their own homework on this project,
but now that we are going to get on their capital,
their list, we will eventually get this done. We haven't
done it. This is rolling, squeegee window cleaners. Nothing.
They won't do them.
Drums.
Wires are too close.
I have nothing, so we are adjourned.
Thank you.
Good.